We're going to continue our dialogue with Maurice Cotterell. We'll also open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with him as well. All that is next on Coast to Coast AM. Maurice, anti-gravity, do you believe the Egyptians might have used this technology to move those blocks of stone?
Absolutely. Just as I believe Leif Skallnin used it to move his blocks. And what I've read is, from what little I've read of the Leif Skallnin story is at Coral Castle, is that the radio equipment was found in his workshop. And so it looks like he was generating anti-gravity, as we discussed earlier, bombarding the artifacts, the coral, and lifting it, or at least giving him an advantage. He may not have been actually generating anti-gravity at the right frequency, but he may have been using a harmonic and at least gaining an advantage. And yes, I believe the Egyptians used it. It makes sense. There's no reason why they shouldn't use it. They were far more advanced than we are today, and we're just becoming getting to grips with that concept, basically.
I think you're right. As a matter of fact, Leif Skallnin had written a book called Magnetic Current, which he believes that you could magnetize or demagnetize any object. It didn't have to just be iron or metal.
Well, it's interesting because I actually read the Leif Skallnin papers. I've not read a book, but a few papers of his. Just a few months ago, 10 months ago at Christmas time, when I decided to look at gravity and figure it out, because I'd really not had time, having been so involved with trying to figure out why we're born, why we die, what God is, what heaven is, what hell is. It was very time-consuming. So we moved house last year, and I decided to, come February, sit down and think about gravity, really think about it. And I read Leif Skallnin's papers, and he came up with a statement, and he said, there is no such thing as permanent magnetism. I think that's what he said. Everything is spinning magnets at atomic level.
Yes.
So I decided to investigate that. I thought, well, that's interesting, because at college I'd been taught that magnetism in magnetic materials resulted from the alignment of sections of the material, which we called domains, D-O-M-A-I-N-S. That was the accepted story. So like the tumbleweed, which is tumbling in all different directions, most materials are made up of little packages, like boxes of matches, all facing different directions. And because of that, there was no overall direction. But with a magnetic material, they all lined up in the same direction from left to right. And so every little domain had a magnet. And when you line them up, you could measure them. It became appreciable, the total magnetic field, and it behaved as a magnet. And we also know that if you stroke a bar of iron with a magnet, then the domains will align themselves in the same direction. And that's that right. Piece of magnetic material, like a screwdriver, will also become magnetic. So I thought, well, that's interesting. So what's causing it? And as it happened, I had a reason for investigating iron. We live in Ireland. We have our own well. We had iron in the water. And I was trying to figure out if I could use magnets from a magnetron from a radar set to filter out the iron without spending a lot of money on all sorts of chemical deactivators.
Right. Good idea.
And, I started to look at the properties of iron, and I didn't capture much iron at all in the filters that I designed, because once the iron oxide hits the water, there's no magnetism in it. It's just the way it is because of how the electrons and how the atoms combine. So I thought, well, what's so special about iron? I'd never actually looked at iron at college, even though it's magnetic. We'd looked at copper because of electron flow. We'd looked at semiconductors because of transistors and so on. And we knew that iron was magnetic, but all we went down to was the domain level, the box of match level. We never got down to the atomic level. So I got on the internet and I started looking at permanent magnetism, iron, and I realized that iron, nickel, and cobalt were all magnetic uniquely. Nothing else was. So I thought, well, what's so special about them? And then I realized that they're actually isotopes. They're not regular atoms. Take a regular atom like calcium. It's balanced. It's got 20 protons, 20 electrons, 20 neutrons.
There's order to it, yeah.
It's very stable. Now, if you take a radioactive atom, we know they're not balanced. We know they are isotopes. They have more neutrons. And they, because of it, they're unstable, and they start giving off radiation, and they actually change themselves over thousands of years into different materials. As they release particles, alpha particles, beta particles, X-rays, the atoms start to degenerate and change into something else. So we know that different materials are made up of different numbers of atoms and protons and electrons. So as the number changes, they become different materials. It's pretty straightforward. So I looked at iron, and I noticed that iron was an isotope, and I thought, well, that's weird. It's not radioactive. Then I read on, it's a stable isotope, doesn't give off energy because it's stable. I thought, well, how can it be? And I looked, and it had common iron has 26 protons, 26 electrons, and 30 neutrons. So I thought, well, that's weird. Maybe this is why iron's magnetic, because I know that the neutron is a spike on the chestnut, and I know that it's spinning through an electrical and magnetic field. I know it's behaving like a generator. So what could be happening with these spiked neutrons? So I knew 26 of the negatives were cancelled out by 26 of the positives. So it seemed to me I had four spikes left. And I pictured these like a cross, one pointing north, one pointing south, one pointing east, one pointing west. It seemed a reasonable assumption. They've got to be somewhere. So I put them equally spaced around the chestnut. And I noticed that the tip of each leg of the cross has got a negative particle, and each the base of every arm of the cross towards the center has got the positive particle. It's a spiked neutron, don't forget, which is positive and negative. And then I thought, well, if I stroked a magnet across this cross, then they would all point in the same direction. Those four legs of the cross would be swept to one side. They would all look like, if you like, the corners of a pyramid. If you imagine the four corners of a pyramid, if you stroke the cross, they all flip over and all go in the same direction, like an arrowhead. Now, don't forget, those are attached to the nucleus, which is spinning through a magnetic field created by the orbiting electrons, which means that every little nucleus is a spinning electromagnet. It's not a magnet, it's an electromagnet. It's generating magnetism. So because iron has spiked neutrons, and because calcium, because it has more spiked neutrons, free spiked neutrons, an excess of them, then the spiked neutron generation is significant. For example, in calcium, the 20 negatives are cancelled out by the 20 positives, and the 20 positives cancel themselves out, because they're negative and positives. It's 20, 20, 20. But in the case of iron, 26 electrons are cancelled out by 26 protons and 26 neutrons, which leaves four spare neutrons to form the cross. When I stroke the cross with a magnet, they all point in the same direction like an arrowhead. So every single atom produces its own arrowhead, all pointing in the same direction. And each of those atoms, as they spin, produces electromagnetism, moving magnetism. It's not permanent, it's moving. It's just that those atoms will not change unless you hit the iron with a hammer. If you hit a magnet with a hammer, it loses its magnetism. Or if you heat it up with a blowtorch, the spiked electrons flip back to their original position. There's nothing to hold them in that forced arrowhead position.
Right, that's right.
So this is Leeds Kalnin was right. He knew that they were spinning magnets. Atoms are spinning magnets, but they're only appreciable as spinning magnets if there is an unbalance between the number of neutrons and positive and negative particles. And this is why iron is magnetic. This is why there's no such thing as permanent magnetism, it's electromagnetism. And what we find is, if you rub iron against iron, like the wheel of a railway track, of a railway carriage against the track, what happens is the spinning magnet of one atom interferes with the spinning of the magnetic of the atom in the wheel, and electromagnetic voltage is induced from one to the other, and the air between the wheel and the carriage passes an electrical current. It breaks down, we get a convection current, which is a spark. So an electrical current moves between two pieces of iron when you hit them together. It doesn't happen with anything else, like aluminium or brass or anything like that. They're non-magnetic, so you don't get a spark from them. So what this means is, now if we look at the inside of the Earth, we've got molten iron flowing around the middle of the Earth, but not in the very center. The very center, although it's 5,000 degrees centigrade, remains solid because the pressure is a lot higher in the center. The pressure of all the Earth being squeezed together is higher. The more you increase the squeezing, the higher the temperature that is required to make it boil.
Do you think that could ever blow up, Maurice?
Could what ever blow up? The Earth?
The core, you do, okay.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think this is, I think planets are born and die, stars are born and die. This is the planetary formation hypothesis, the evolution of planets, can be considered as living things. For example, our Earth will become more and more active as the magnetic field of the Earth misaligns with the magnetic field of the Sun. They're usually aligned. The Sun is like a magnet, and the Earth is like a compass of the needle of a compass.
Right. Oh, sure.
So if the Sun's magnetic field twists, then the Earth will twist, or it should twist off its axis. And if it doesn't, the magnetic fields are misaligned. What happens then is you get electrical currents flowing in the magma. And so the magma starts to change direction. And the generated field, what's happening is, where this molten magma is flowing around the solid core, you've got two iron bits of iron moving together, like the railway carriage and the wheel, and you're getting an electric current generated between the two, where they interface, where they slide around each other. And so we get a donut inside the Earth of electrical current flowing around inside of the Earth. It's donut-shaped inside the middle because more heat is being conveyed from the equator to the middle of the Earth from the Sun than it is from the North Pole to the Sun. So the rotating magma is not like a ball, like a football. It's like a donut swirling around the solid football-shaped core. And that generates an electrical current, which is an electromagnet. And that's how the Earth's dynamo works. That's why the Earth has a magnetic field. That magnetic field, once it's generated, because it hasn't always been here, depends on the age of the planet, once it's been here, that field starts to interfere with the Sun's solar wind, and the planet starts to spin on its axis. Once it starts to spin on its axis, it starts to orbit the Sun. And so it's all of this evolution of planetary birth, life, and death is very complex and very interesting, and it's not an area which has ever been looked at before, because people don't know why the inside of the Earth's hot, just as they don't know why when you drop something it finishes up on the floor. And it's hard to believe that mankind can be so ignorant of the world around us not to understand why when we drop a ballpoint pen it finishes up on the carpet. It's ignorant of us to not understand why the middle of the Earth is hot when we see it spewing out of volcanoes. And, of course, if the pressure gets hotter over time, there will come a time when the planet explodes and we become asteroids in space, like the rings of Saturn or so on.
So true. Let's take some calls, Maurice. You ready for a few?
Sure.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Goodness me, is this me?
It is you, it is.
Hi, thank you. This is Angie. I'm from Berkeley, and it has been a joy to listen. I'm going to have to stay up all night and listen to it again. I have a couple of questions that I would like to ask, so let me just ask them, and then I can listen on the answers on the radio.
Okay, sure.
One of them is please forgive me, I just forgot your guest name.
Maurice Cotterell.
Oh, Maurice, forgive me, Maurice. I am so sorry. You are wonderful. I would love to have tea with you. Have you, by any chance, read Holy Blood, Holy Grail?
Yes, I have, Angie, but many years ago.
Because what I wanted to mention to you is the exact thing that you were saying in regards to Earth being hell, the material being basically hell and the devil and that kind of thing is exactly what the Cathars believed. And the Cathars were the Albigenians with the heresy that the Catholic Church came in. And that was from the Priory of Zion, which led to the Knights Templar, which led to the Masons. And
absolutely, Angie, absolutely. And, of course, the Mayas believed that this was hell. And once we understand why the Mayas sacrificed the winners of the ball game, it all becomes clear as to why they were doing this. It all makes sense.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yes. My question then also was, in speaking of gravity, it seems to me, one of the things is that I was born with a long memory, and I go between here and home all the time. And one of the things that I've noticed is that when I'm here, everything is reflected light. I mean, in other words, the grass, you don't see anything in the dark, but at home on the other side, everything generates its own light.
Clearly, yes. And indeed, this is why stained glass is used in churches.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the light flowing through the glass. It's God who is light. God is light, electromagnetic energy, which allows you to have the vision to behold the beauty that's in front of us.
Oh, how lovely. But here's one of the things that is, now I never found a transmigration of species. But then again, you know, I mean, there are, the Hindus believe in transmigration of species. You know, you get better, you become a higher level. But I did not find that to be so. But my question is, do you feel that there is a relationship between gravity and linear time that...
Yeah, well, let me stop you there, Angie, because it's a very interesting point. I've explained in most of my books, you know, on the Mayas, all of the, every book on each civilization, that there is no such thing as time. Time began when the universe began. Because if we go back to when God was just energy, in the beginning we had light. That's all we had was energy. So nothing happened. Nothing happened before anything else. Nothing happened after anything else. Now what happened was when God decided to create the physical universe, some of his energy was transferred and became the material world. And then we had the planets were born, the trees were born, the night and the day began. Things started to happen before other things and after other things. What this teaches us is that time only exists in the physical world. It doesn't exist in the world of energy, in the soul world, in the world of light. And this is why, although we look in the mirror and see our face acquiring wrinkles and our hair turning to grey, the soul inside feels the same at 8 as it does at 28, at 38, at 88, because the soul doesn't get old. Only the body gets old, and only the body decays. And when the soul leaves the body, it carries on, and it can go to the soul world for thousands of worlds, to purgatory. If we look at the information that the Mayas left behind, they tell us that purgatory exists, and it's the place where souls who have sinned have to go to, because that's where the heart is purged of sin, and the voltage is made higher as the impurity is released. And that's when we're ready to come back to Earth for another chance of purification, for another chance to go to heaven again.
Maurice, you think we'll ever run out of souls for bodies?
It doesn't work that way, George, because what happened was, thousands of years ago when they built the pyramids, there were fewer people, but each soul was a higher voltage. So in those days, the pharaohs were 1,000 volts each, but there was only 100 pharaohs. But now, we're only 1 microvolt each, but there's billions of people. So this is why we're into a cycle, a spiral of decay, if you like, whereby the Earth is created with Adam and Eve, two people with 500 billion volts each. But then, after time, they have children, their children have children, then they start fighting and squabbling because there's not enough food to go around, so they emigrate to different countries, then their children get mutated by X-rays from the sun, from solar flares. Some have black children, some have brown children, some have yellow children, depending on the number of X-rays that mutate the genes. So they don't see each other as brother and sisters anymore. Thousands of years later, they start killing each other and having wars because they've run out of food. And this vicious cycle carries on, and the souls get lower and lower voltage until we get to the end of a 5,000-year cycle.
All right, we'll be back, Maurice, and final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Maurice Cotterell. We're going to take your phone calls as well. Maurice, would you like to give out your website for us?
Sure. It's www.mauricecotterell.com. That's MauriceCotterell.com.
And that is charged with a lot of information. As a matter of fact, you give out information on gravity. There's a download on the website, right?
There isn't, George, and I have to do that. I haven't done that for commercial reasons. I could put it on the web. I've already given several listeners copies of it, but I've decided I can't give any more away because until I have a publishing contract in place or a documentary deal, then the producer or the publisher would be aggrieved at the information going out of the door before they've had a chance to sell it.
That happens.
So it's as simple as that. I'm happy to talk about it, but as for the actual diagrams and more details of it, that's going to have to wait until the book, which hopefully will be out next year or the year after, or the documentary. And what I do find after a broadcast, George, is I do get lots of emails from people saying, look, which of these books on your website do I need to read? And the answer to that is, look, if you'd like to understand how the Mayas and the Freemasons and the Egyptians understood all of this knowledge we've been talking about tonight, you need to read the Tutankhamun prophecies. If you'd like to read how the Incas understood all this stuff, then read The Lost Tomb of Viracocha. If you'd like to understand how the ancient Chinese understood all this stuff, read The Terracotta Warriors. And if you'd like to understand how the Celtic people understood all this stuff, have a look at Jesus, King Arthur, and The Journey of the Grail. All of these books explain how the sun affects life on Earth, how we get to heaven, what God is, and how these ancient civilizations left all of this information behind in their treasures, in their art, in their carvings, in their jewelry, in their pyramids, all encoded, so that those who had took the time to decode it could find their own way to heaven.
Maurice, I was thinking about when the first time you and I started talking, and gosh, it must have been back in 2001. Can you believe how fast time clicks?
It's amazing, George, isn't it? And I can't believe just how much research has gone under the bridge since that time and how comfortable I feel with it all and how pleased I've been to share it with all your listeners. I get many emails. They're very supportive, very appreciative, and it's wonderful to be part of it.
I remember the reverse images that I first got from you on one of your first books, and I looked at it, and you hold them over each other and overlap them, and something happened of lost information that just never got passed down to us that somehow the ancients knew. And I don't know about that gap, Maurice. I don't know what happened.
Well, what happened was, if we look at the ancient religions tell us what happened. If we look at the Brahmins of India, they tell us in the Vedas and the Hindu scriptures that whenever purity decays on Earth, then God reincarnates himself and sends a messenger to Earth. So God first came to Earth as Krishna 5,000 years ago, and again around 2700 BC. Krishna or Christ, or the anointed one. He then came back as Tutankhamun, the son of God, about 1353 BC. So Tutankhamun, the son of God, came back and tried to explain to everybody how the sun affected life on Earth. Then Tutankhamun came back because we're told by the Indian scriptures that the Indian Godhead, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, that Vishnu came back as Krishna, and then he reincarnated as Buddha. So we know that Krishna came back as Buddha if we read the Indian scriptures. And, of course, Krishna taught that heaven was, as I mentioned earlier, the milky ocean. And this is why the Brahmins worship the cow, which gives milk, this sacred creature, because they're associated with heaven. And this is why in Peru they called the gods who performed miracles in Peru, the legendary white gods that walked the length of Peru, carving the lines into the desert in Nazca, mm-hmm. and telling us all about how the sun affects life on Earth, they called them Viracocha and Viracocha Pachacamac. Viracocha means foam of the sea, which is a milky ocean. And it's only when we're in the foam of the sea, if you take a walk in the foam of the sea, you'll realize that that's the only time you're in contact with the earth, the air, the water, and the heat from the sun, the fire. If you take a step onto the land, you lose the water. If you take a step into the water, you lose the land. So the perfect being is in the foam of the sea, Viracocha. And, of course, Viracocha is regarded as a crab, the crab man, because he lives in the foam of the sea, on land and in water. And once we realize that these sons of God, in fact, they are the one son of God who keeps coming back. Once we examine all the ancient artifacts, it becomes clear that they couldn't have been different people at the same time, because, for example, if you look in Tutankhamun's coffin, there was a body. So we know mm-hmm. Tutankhamun lived in a human body, and he taught the super science of the sun. If you move to Palenque, you'll find a body of Lord Peikau of the Maya in his sarcophagus there. So Lord Peikau was a different body to Tutankhamun, who was a different body to Viracocha, who lived in Peru. So what the only explanation, the only rational explanation, is that this same spiritual energy, this son of God, comes back at different times in a different body and teaches the same lessons to mankind.
Over and over again.
Over and over again. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Back to the phones. Go ahead, Maurice.
And once we get into the reincarnation model, the transmigration of souls, and how it could all be scientifically possible, then again it all makes sense, because as the Christians believe, when we die, we either go to heaven or hell, which is exactly what the Hindu believe. If we go to hell, we come back to earth, because the earth is hell. So it's the same thing, it's just a different way of looking at it.
Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, this is Nick of San Antonio.
Hi, Nick. Thanks.
I have a question from Reese. This has been wonderful. A friend of mine, Larry, won't give his last name. He worked at Caltech in the 60s and devoted his whole life to threefold principle, very similar to what you were saying. And I'll listen to your comments off the air and off the phone on here. First of all, that there's something. There's a figure eight pattern, or what they call a cycloid pattern. He played tennis a lot, and he compared it to batting a ball back and forth across the net. That represented two dynamics similar. Not electrons, but something else that had a universal attractive force, which he called magnetism, as opposed to electrons, which repel and represent this hell on Earth. And that exact same principle applied to the planets and other celestial bodies. And then he said that this attractive principle was the principle of love. And it all performed a threefold model, starting at the center of the atom and the nucleus. I'll listen to your comment on this universal attractive particle, and that magnetism actually displaces gravity as the main controlling force.
All right. Very good, Nick. Thank you. You want to react to that, Maurice? Sure.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's a good observation, Nick, and I take it on board. And interestingly, we were talking about anti-gravity before and how hydrogen is uniquely... it doesn't bond covalently, it doesn't bond using the figure eight. And it seemed to me, or seems to me, that hydrogen, because it gives off a gravity, must bond gravitationally. And this is very interesting, because if we go back to anti-gravity, what this means is, if we use anti-gravity to levitate a rocket, what we could do is break down the molecules in any hydrogen material. Any material that contains hydrogen would cease to be bonded using gravitational bonding, because the anti-gravity would overcome it. So it would be one thing beaming anti-gravity onto iron, which has no water in it. It would levitate off the Earth. But if you beamed the gravity onto an astronaut who is made of water, 90% water, then the water molecules would cease to bond together, and so the astronaut would disintegrate. So we have to be very careful when we start to talk about anti-gravity and the use of anti-gravity. It looks like it can't be used for biological organisms which have water in them.
Okay, thank you. Next wildcard line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello? One more time. Nope, we're going to have to let him go. East of the Rockies, you're up there. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Wow, you guys are really doing it up tonight. Maurice, you're a great whole guest tonight and a saint. You're talking about many things that, as you mentioned earlier, that are already known by so-called governments and so-called religions. And this very objective understanding of our nature and ourselves is being hidden from man so that we can't gain control of our own understanding of our lives. And I think it's really a shame. I just wanted to touch on three points and see what you thought of them. One was the concept of time, which you discussed earlier before the break. And it is really a concept that we've allowed other people to define for us. I can remember in school being told that the earlier sun worshipers were pagans, that they didn't know this Christ God. But in truth, what we've done is translated our understanding of the sun and put it on the clock and put it on other devices, and it's used to rule and control people's lives.
Absolutely. A case in point is how the Spaniards went to Mexico, Tenochtitlan, and slaughtered all the Spaniards because they were pagans who believed in gods and so on. But what we find is that the ancestors of the Aztecs were the Mayans, and the leader of the Mayans was a reincarnation of Christ, Lord Peikal. If we look at the word Peikal, that is very similar to the Christian Catholic word for Pascal, which is Easter, which tells us that Jesus died on the cross at Easter. And if we look at the information left behind by Lord Peikal in the overlays that George was talking about, we can see Christ dying on the cross. We can also see Viracocha dying on the cross, which tells us that Lord Peikal and Viracocha were all reincarnations of Christ. And so the Spaniards who believed in Christ killed Christ-worshipping people who believed in a previous incarnation of Christ. Mm-hmm. And once you get your head around that, it makes you realize just how futile and pointless it all was.
Did you see the movie Apocalypto, Mel Gibson movie? I would have loved to get your reaction to that. They showed a very violent Maya civilization, Maurice.
Yes, I know. It's terrible. It's terrible how they misportray such a loving, peaceful civilization that practiced and preached love thy neighbor and love God. The Mayans were not anything like the Aztecs. You see, what the Mayans were trying to tell us was the sun affected life on Earth, how it affected personality determination, how it affected menstruation. So they had carvings of men putting cactus spikes through their penis. They were trying to tell us there was no genital blood. The problem was lack of menstruation. There was no menstruation. The sun was failing their fertility needs. How else can you explain to people who are going to come after us 1,000 years later that periodically the sun stops sending out particles of radiation, the women stop menstruating, and you stop having babies? How do you convey that concept? It's very complicated to a non-scientific civilization. So they showed men sticking spikes in their penises. So what do the Aztecs do? The Aztecs have come along 500 years later, say, hey, look at these guys. They're all a bunch of weirdos. They're bloodthirsty. They're all masochists. They stick spikes in their penises. They're all fruitcakes. These guys are mad. And so the Aztecs started sticking spikes in each other, ripping hearts out of each other. They thought that was the way to get the message. They misread the message, and they lost their way. And even now, archaeologists today haven't got the brains to make the distinction between the Aztecs and the Mayans. But once you start to look at the pictures they left behind, which are in all of my books, you can see firsthand the evidence of what Jesus left behind every time he incarnated on Earth. We can see that what he left behind in the Holy Grail, which is in the Dublin Museum, the same information that's been left behind in the pyramids of Peru and Egypt and Mexico. It tells us how to get to heaven. It tells us what God is, what life is, what reincarnation is. But you see, these archaeologists, they have very little soul voltage inside. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in heaven. They spend their whole lives in the dark digging up dead bodies. They don't understand God. And as soon as you start talking about God, they go on defrost. They become completely unstable, and you can't get through to them. You know, that's not, life is not about dead bodies. Life is about the living and godly energy and love. That's what life is all about. And in thousands of years' time, when these archaeologists have come back as slugs and snails, and they've suffered greatly, and their soul voltage starts to go up again, they will see the light one day. They might not believe in God, but God believes in them.
First-time caller line. We might have time for one or two more. Go ahead.
Hello, George and Maurice. My name is David, and I live in White City, Oregon.
Hi, David.
Hello, and all the millions of viewers, our listeners, hello. I have a question and just a couple quick comments. As to your theory on gravity, I find very compelling. Every theory must be testable, and it must be able to make predictions. And that's my question to you. What are your predictions, and how can you test it? And a quick comment would be I've always told people that if the human race had a union, I'd be on strike. And if there was any such thing as reincarnation, I'm retiring. With that, I have this early memory, and I thought at first I thought it was a dream, but it was so early. I remember that I was in a very heavenly place, and it was like It's very difficult to describe because it is beyond words, but the place was, it was a place of light, and it was vast, and there were many people there, and it was like I was being prepared. And I guess the way I interpret that is that I guess I was being prepared to enter into this world. And I say that as being a Christian. And I'd like to hear your comments.
All right, and a minute to go, Maurice.
Fine, thanks. I'll try to cover that as quickly as I can, David. As for the testing of the hypothesis, short of building a model of the universe, what we need to do now is fire more X-rays at more atoms, determine the electromagnetic radiation coming off them. I believe the radiation will be X-ray frequency. And this is why I also believe that X-rays, although they're electromagnetic energy, I believe they're also corkscrew polarized. In other words, this is what gives them their penetrative ability. This is why X-rays go straight through us, because they're like a corkscrew. So there are tests we can do now on the atom. We've got to look at what frequency what atom responds to and what they resonate at. I discovered how astrology worked 20 years ago, and again, people said, well, how are you going to test it? Well, I can see it all around me. I can see different personalities. I can see how different personalities respond and fall out and argue and love and so on. But short of building a model of the universe, there's nothing else I can do except rationally put forward this scientific hypothesis, which fits the equations of Newton. And the fact that it does fit the equations of Newton should be weight of in itself to carry it forward. As for reincarnation in the human race...
Well, we're not going to have time for that one, Maurice. We've got the clock here, but I want to thank you for bringing us an enlightening evening.
That's okay, George. You're very welcome. And let me thank your listeners for listening, and I hope they've enjoyed it.
Maurice Cotterell, if you need more information on him, just go to the coasttocoastam.com website. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.